Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
It's Thursday, April 18th, and your Ben Jarofsky Show starts now. On the show today, Ben welcomes Executive Director of Education Post, Peter Cunningham. The Ben Jarofsky Show, a presentation of the Chicago Reader. ChicagoReader.com for everything there is to know in the city of Chicago. I know you want to know what to do. I know you want to know where to go. I know you want to know what to eat, what to drink. Well, I have the answer for you. The Best of Chicago happening at the Lincoln Park Zoo next week, the 25th. Get your tickets right now at ChicagoReader.com. And if you want more Ben Jarofsky after the show, head to ChicagoReader.com/Jarofsky. That's J-O-R-A, V as in victory, S-K-Y.
Hello again, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. We're calling this Recall Decision Thursday, and here's why. I got Peter Cunningham sitting by, but before I bring him on, I'm going to tell you what's on my mind, ladies and gentlemen. So when you're the host of a fabulously successful and much-watched podcast, millions and millions of people waiting every day to hear what you're going to say about the events of the day, you can't just sit around and pontificate and duck and dodge and evade. You can't go Pritzker on people with questions, with answers that do like little foxtrots and avoid the central question. You can't be like Brandon Johnson and randomly misquote rappers to try to like deter the reporters. You can't be Donald Trump babbling on about this, that, and the other thing incoherently, like sending little messages that only MAGA picks up. No, you have to give a definitive answer. Okay? So now the question to me posed by Peter Cunningham, even though he didn't pose it, but I'm pretending he would pose it, is would I sign the petition asking that voters be allowed to recall Mayor Brandon Johnson? Yes, yes, this story broke yesterday. It's in my beloved Bright One, the Chicago Sun-Times today, so it must be true. And it tells about the story of a gentleman who lives, I believe he lives on the north side of Chicago. Yes, he lives in Lakeview. And he is launching an effort to recall Brandon Johnson. And ladies and gentlemen, this is not going to be an easy effort. Okay, he's got to get like 56,000 or something signatures to his petitions, getting it on the ballot in November. And then if I'm reading the story correctly, even if it passes in November, if it passes, then he has to get a whole bunch of other signatures to get it on the ballot to actually recall. So it's kind of confusing, but it seems like the first vote is on whether you want to have official recall vote. Hey, man, if you got a problem with me, just call the Sun-Times and ask them. Maybe they can explain it to you. Anyway, turns out he's getting assistance on this endeavor from my old friend, Pat Quinn. Patrick Quinn, former governor of the state of Illinois, was on the show about 3 weeks ago. Now, that leads me. Would I sign this endeavor? Well, it's true, ladies and gentlemen. I did sign Pat Quinn's petition calling on voters to get an opportunity to have term limits for Mayor Rahm. Well, it was going to be term limits for all mayors, but it was viewed as a shot at Mayor Rahm. And the only reason I did that was because I went to breakfast with Pat Quinn to do a story about it, and he talked me into it, ladies and gentlemen. It's his fault. Blame him. So I did sign it, even though I kind of have like an opposition to term limits. But it's like he was so compelling, Pat Quinn, over eggs, that I signed it. I bent to him. If only Pete Cunningham saying, God dang, if it was that easy to get Ben to bend to my thoughts, I would have taken him to breakfast all those years when I was working for Daily. But I'm not going to sign this petition. First of all, I kind of agree with listener Frank on this. Sometimes we go too far with voter referendums. And I'm like, you know, we just elected the guy. Now, I wouldn't have signed a petition to recall Mayor Rahm. And I was through with Mayor Rahm like 3 months into his administration at his first budget hearing. I go, oh, this guy, I can't deal with him. I wouldn't have signed a petition to recall Mayor Daley. And Peter Cunningham knows that I wrote many columns critical of Mayor Daley. I just voted against Mayor Daley in every election. I always lost. I always thought that was our opportunity. You know, I mean, why recall the guy unless he does something completely and totally outrageous? I don't know, like burying evidence of a police murder. Oh, wait, one of our mayors did do that. I still don't know if I would recall Mayor Rahm for burying Laquan McDonald. But then this guy really goes off. I'm not going to read. Listen to this. He really goes, I don't know. He goes off the rails with this one. And here's this quote to Fran Spielman of the Sun-Times. The thing that motivated me more than anything else was when Mayor Johnson had a meeting scheduled with your editorial board at the Sun-Times and then canceled it because you wouldn't go off the record. I thought that just violated every principle of honor and integrity. I'm sorry, Peter. I am laughing as I say that. I mean, for Christ, listen, we made fun of Ronnie Reese, New Colony 6. We made fun of Ronnie Reese on this show for pulling that stunt. We had a good laugh at it. But to recall the mayor because he told us sometimes he wanted to go off the record, kind of extreme. Particularly, it's not even the worst thing mayors have done to reporters. Peter Cunningham knows what I could do a riff right now. Mayor Daley threatening my dear friend, Mick Dumpke, threatening to shoot him. Where was this guy from Lakeview with recall petitions to recall Mayor Daley when he threatened to shoot Mick Dumpke? And how? Oh, this is what long before even Peter Cunningham came to town. Mayor Jane Byrne. I'm not making this up, Peter. Mayor Jane Byrne. You ask your old friends like David Axelrod. He'll tell you. Mayor Jane Byrne removed the desk of the Tribune reporter from the press room. A guy named Davis, I think his name was. This is like 1980. It's ancient history. Only dinosaurs remember this. He removed the desk because he got mad at some guy. It was like a big deal. You can't. They took the desk out of the press room at City Hall. Where was this guy? What's his name? Bolin. Where was his? He would. Well, okay. Now you're going to go. And that was in 1980.
Maybe he wasn't born yet. Maybe he wasn't born yet.
No, he was. He's 57, according to the Bright One. So you do the math, Peter. He was born in 19. He was about 16. All right. So probably he wasn't paying attention. But I don't know. I think that's more extreme than asking the editorial board to go off the record. And then, of course, Mayor Lori Lightfoot was always squabbling with some, getting fights with Gregory Pratt, basically telling him he got the story wrong when actually he got it right. She got it wrong. I mean, I don't know. This is pretty pathetic, in my opinion, to launch a recall drive because you're upset that he asked to go off the record. So sorry, Pat Quinn. You know I love you dearly, but no way am I signing this petition. It's too bizarre to believe. All right, Peter Cunningham is my guest. I've been patiently waiting. Great speechwriter for Mayor Daley. Not Mayor Rahm. He always points out to me he did not advise Mayor Rahm. All right, I will not hold you accountable or responsible for any of the things Mayor Rahm did. But he was a speechwriter for Arne Duncan, and he is working with Arne on trying to deal with violence in the city of Chicago. And he's our resident show expert on policing matters. Comes on every other month or so to talk about it. So first of all, welcome back, Cotter. Good to see your smiling face. We have a lot to talk about.
Nice to be here, as always, Ben. It's good to learn that for 3 months you were actually with Mayor Rahm. I didn't realize that. That's real news. That's the kind of thing your listeners need to know about.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that's accurate that I was with him. He had that. What do they call it? Like the honeymoon last. The honeymoon. He got elected, as I recall, in February. He took oath of office in May, and so August. I don't know if you were at that. You probably were not at that. You have a life. You were not at that budget hearing at Kennedy King College that he held. And that's where I just.
I feel like this recall issue is a little bit like the elected school board issue. It's that if your candidate for mayor is not successful, then you're for a recall. And if he is, he or she is, maybe you're not for it. Similarly, if you're, if you don't like where the mayor is going on the schools, you want an elected school board. But if you do like where the mayor is going on schools, maybe you're not as enthusiastic about it, which I think is kind of the situation right now. Either way, I think I'm with you on this. I kind of feel like recalls just make it harder to do the things you're supposed to do when you lead at the state or city level. You know, if you have to, you know, we all know politics is always present, not just in Chicago, but everywhere. And when you're trying to drive policy change, you have to be mindful of politics, no matter how much you don't want to be. But you hope that at least it's on the back burner once you get past the election and you can say, okay, we may have to do some tough things that aren't popular, but let's try and do them. Well, if you have to worry about a recall possibility at all times, I don't think that's helpful to the cause of getting stuff done. Now, this guy needs 56,000 signatures just to get it on the ballot, the option for a recall. And as we know, you probably want at least 2-to-1 signatures to withstand a challenge, or in this case, maybe, you know, an extra 25 or 30,000. So he made 80, 90,000 signatures. That's a lot of signatures. And when we talk about the elected school board, we could talk about that as well. And then, just to be clear, then he would actually put the recall on the ballot, but that takes 120,000 signatures, according to Sun Times. So, I mean, I don't think this is going to happen. I'd be really shocked if he got any
I would hear
that. But broadly speaking, I kind of think that it's just an unproductive thing. It was interesting. I looked up recalls before the call because I was curious how many places had them. 19 states have a version of it, and I didn't get the number on how many cities have it. But there were pros and cons on the argument. One of the cons was they called it an excess of democracy. I thought it was an interesting phrase, an excess of democracy.
That is an interesting excess of democracy. We had a whole conversation yesterday's show with Monroe Anderson as to whether Chicago is a democracy. Interesting conversation. We're all on the subject. I'll tell you this. I'm pretty consistent on this, as opposed to other things where I'm all over the map. I oppose the recall effort for Scott Walker. Now, I don't know where you were in 2011. You probably were working. I don't know where you were. You're probably working for Arnie in Washington. So you may not be paying.
Yeah, I was in Washington, but I know all about it. Yeah.
Okay.
In Wisconsin, you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was the, I don't want to redo history. We could go down this path and we have other things to talk about, but a colossal failure by the Democratic Party in 2010 led to the midterm disasters. Wisconsin was taken over by Scott Walker, and he eviscerated the unions in the state of Wisconsin. And the Democrats have been paying for it ever since. But they have some smart people running the state right now, Peter. And so we're finally emerging from the trauma of what Walker did. That said, I feel as though the people elected Scott Walker. You have 4 years if you're in opposition to build your case to defeat him. It seemed.
Only did they not recall him, he then was reelected.
Yes. Right? It seems like a wasted effort. You know, the real effort should have been to fight
him in the first place. Yeah. No question about it. Wisconsin is just amazing. I mean, Tammy Baldwin's now up there. We need that seat. Tony Evers is constantly under siege. He's the governor. And, you know, every analysis of the 2024 election, and I know we're maybe going to talk about that a little later, just shows Wisconsin being just an absolutely crucial state. And, of course, it was for the last two elections.
Yeah, and Michigan as well. We'll get into that. All right. So we see eye to eye on that. Although I do believe, well, let's go right into schools because it's a perfect segue. I do believe it's a bit of a false equivalency to say a mayoral recall is roughly the equivalent of electing a school board. You could say there's too much democracy in the world, but I think a fundamental tenet of democracy is to have an elected school board. And I say that knowing Peter, and I know this. Actually, Peter Cunningham warned me of this about 5 years ago. We had a conversation while he was driving through the rain in a car. You warned me, you know, Ben, don't be careful what you ask for, because you could end up with a school board that you don't like. I don't know if you remember this conversation.
I do, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're right. You're absolutely correct. It could be, you know, a corporate driven school board that tries to bring back charters and eviscerate the teachers. And you're absolutely correct. Things that I would not want to happen could happen. once we have an elected school board. And so you were saying that it might be just better off for all of us if we just left the schools under the control of the mayor. I still believe in a democratically elected school board. And I look to what happened in Arlington Heights as an example. In Arlington Heights, the school boards and around Arlington Heights have are protecting the tax base from a handout to the Bears. And they're doing that primarily because it's not in the interest of their budgets and their children to give the Bears a big property tax handout. And under the way we do in the way we do business in Chicago, we don't have that safeguard, in my humble opinion. So that I'll open that thought and get your response, and we'll take it from there. Go ahead.
I mean, it's a fair point, I guess. Was it the school that blocked the Bears subsidy in Arlington Heights, or was it just the local government? Either way, you know, you have elected local government, you have elected school board, and they blocked it, and good for them. And I agree with that. And I agree with that, you know, we shouldn't be subsidizing another stadium for them or for the Sox. I mean, there may be a public contribution required in both cases for infrastructure, something like that. But, you know, we haven't even paid off the bonds on either of those stadiums, I think. So it's crazy that they're looking for new stadiums right already. That's that. What I was really talking about was the fact that the enthusiasm for elected school board escalated when there was a lot of opposition to Mayor Emanuel, and it seemed to de-escalate when they were successfully elected a candidate favored by the CTU. So here we are. And my bigger concern about it, and again, you know, it's the law, and, you know, that's yesterday's battle. It's the law, and we're going to have an elected school board in Chicago. Is 21 members, I think, is crazy. And I think the process is not very open, frankly, to people. I'll give you an example. The night before that final school board bill was passed, which was just a month ago or so, they boosted the number of signatures required to 1,000 from 250. There was no public debate about that, no discussion. But think about the consequences of that. As I said, to withstand a petition challenge, you need 2 to 3 times the number of signatures. So 2,000 to 3,000 signatures, we have 21. Well, this year we'll have 10 people running, 10 districts. I mean, it could take a half a day to get 10 signatures. It could take you a week to get 100, not around the clock. And folks, we're trying to democratize this process, get people involved, and they got to put together, you know, operations to collect those signatures. That's not insignificant. And so I think that's one issue. I think one of the issues is it's not paid, and therefore a lot of people just can't afford to be on it. So then who will be on it? Is the next question. Who can afford to devote the time? I mean, these agendas for the school board meetings are 1,000 pages long. I mean, even to have a cursory understanding of what you're voting on requires a lot of homework. So, you know, I would just like that process to be evaluated. We're going to go through one round this fall, and then there'll be another one. All 20 districts will be up in 26. And the citywide school board president will be up. So it's going to be a really interesting adventure for the whole city. And like I said, you know, the debate about whether to have one is over. So now it's just about how to have a good school board that, you know, can get stuff done and do the right thing for kids. And to be honest, I'm not sure that, say, having a recall procedure for them is a good idea, because then they just have to worry about that politics over their shoulder every single time they cast a vote, instead of putting aside, you know, realizing, okay, we get election every 4 years, or in some cases every 2 years. And, you know, let's focus on doing the right thing in between. You know, that's the way it's supposed to work.
I think what you're getting at is the difference between principle and tactics, a favorite topic on this show. So the principle, when there were, activists were upset with Rahm for what he was doing, the schools advocated a principle of democracy, when in fact it was a tactic that they were employing. They were trying to get a political advantage over Rahm. So they advocated a principle. So now here they're not advocating the principle so much, because the situation has changed and they need different tactics. So it's, I always talk about this, the difference between a principle and a tactic. It's a civics class here on the Ben Jarofsky Show, Peter. We're always trying to get at the heart of things. And so I remember having many conversations with the late, great Karen Lewis about this and quoting you to her, although she didn't need you to tell, you know what I mean? She understood the situation very well. I there's people like Pat Quinn who I think after all these years genuinely believe in democracy.
Yep, me too. He's one of my heroes. He's great. He's a great, yeah. great guy, great leader. And he's just never, ever stopped, you know, working hard for like a better Chicago, a better Illinois. I mean, he's a great guy.
Yeah. So he actually believes in this stuff, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not quite sure anybody else does because it's really tough to have. It's the TIFFs. I remember the first conversations you and I had about TIFFs. And it was like a really great conversation. I wish that was on a mic, but you were talking about, you know, like what you call it, off the shelf money that every mayor needs. And I took that to heart because I believe that pretty much every mayor would want to keep the TIF program around because mm-hmm. it was money that he or she controlled. And you need money. You know how many budget directors have told me that, Peter? You need money to run this city. And so now I'm watching the fight here in City Hall over whether they keep the TIF program whether to let TIF districts die. I don't know if they're going to go through with it because they want that money, Peter. You follow?
I understand. And you know what? I get it. I mean, I supported the Bring Chicago Home Ordinance proposal. You know, the mayor wants to do something bold. He wanted to address the homeless issue in an honest, straightforward way with a real revenue stream. And I supported it. I support his thing to borrow the money for the affordable housing. I don't know how else to do it. So I get it. And I realize that every policy has ups and downs. And you and I have talked a lot about the downsides of the TIF policy, in your opinion. And I get that. But if you're mayor and you get elected, and you get elected promising to do some stuff, then you ought to have the tools to be able to try and do it. And if we just add more and more barriers to it, then, you know, we're never going to get stuff done. You know, you look at like how the affordable housing crisis is really gone national. It's now true in scores of cities, if not hundreds. It's true in lots of suburbs. It's true in lots of places where you just can't afford to live and you just have to spend too much of your income. And, you know, I'm talking about a lot of Americans, not necessarily myself here, but I'm just being honest about a challenge. And who's going to have the courage to take on all those local zoning laws that get in the way? And certainly, it doesn't help if they have to worry about recalls, but who's going to have the courage to really go after that? Look at California. I mean, they're going to have to do something about that. And it's unaffordable. They just don't have the raw number of roofs they need to house people, let alone the cost. So I just think that we have to be thinking about how to build a government, how to evolve government in a way that can get things done as opposed to making it harder to get things done.
All right. We seem to be heading in the other direction, making it harder to get things done.
I think so.
That's where we're. And then, of course, I have the issue with some of the things that get done, which I object to.
We can have those debates. We can have those debates about what the things are to get done. But, Mayor Johnson wanted to do something about homelessness, and I can give you all kinds of, thoughts about what he could have done differently or how they could have messaged that differently. But the bottom line is he didn't get that revenue stream.
And well, how could he have messaged it differently?
Well, he didn't tell us what he was going to do, first of all. Most people say that. And, I follow the issue pretty closely. He didn't really explain I always use the homeless as a great example when I'm talking to conservatives who believe that, smaller government, lower taxes is the only thing that to do. I always say, okay, tell me what you'll do with homelessness. There's only three choices. Okay, you can leave them on the sidewalk to steal or die, or starve and die. You can put them in jail, which some places still do, and we all used to do. Or you can house them, treat them, and feed them. And that costs money. But maybe if you really did a fair analysis, maybe you'd find that it costs less to do that than it does to leave them on the streets. So, he's not going to be able to do that. But he should have been more explicit about what a solution to homelessness looked like. And I think he even admitted himself for some reason he felt hamstrung and unable to get out there to advocate for it. I don't know why he felt that way. So, you know, somebody maybe told him he wasn't allowed to advocate for it, whatever. I don't know the, I don't know the legalistics of it, but either way, nobody knew what he's going to do with it. And when politicians ask you for money and just say, trust me, usually people say no. When they ask you for money and say, this is exactly what I'm going to do with it, maybe they're more willing to tell you. You know, if you want to raise money for school funding so that you can shrink class sizes or pay teachers more or build some new schools, people generally say yes. When you say, I just want to raise money in order to feed the bureaucracy, they say no. So I think that would have helped a lot. I mean, he only lost by, it was less than 10 points, so it was winnable.
Yeah, it was very winnable. And we made fun of him on the show for that explanation. I believe it was something along the lines that one of his advisors told him that it would be against the rules for him to advocate, which I just took great delight at.
Who told him that?
What lawyer told him that?
Right.
Oh my God.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. And of course, the other element at play was the low voter turnout in the last election, which was like 25% or 26%. I forget where it ended up.
So, right. I don't understand why everybody just isn't in the business of registering voters like constantly registering voters. Just, I mean, they, you know, you have to be communicating to them constantly. You can't just show up at election time and say, oh, please, you know, do it right now. You know me, I'm a communications guy, and I believe that we should be telling people every single day what we're doing to make their lives better, whether you work for government or work for nonprofits like I'm working for these days.
Well, now we're heading down a path, and I got so much on the stuff I want to talk to you about, but it's in the best interest of incumbents by and large, not to have big turnout, not to have, that's makes it easier for them to get reelected. So I think I just answered your question. All right, so before we leave schools behind, you teased me with a mention briefly on the phone when I set the interview up, that you ran for local school council. You were defeated, but some of the experience can sort of open your eyes. So why don't you have the floor?
I ran for local school council in elementary school in my neighborhood. When I filed, there was an empty seat, an empty community seat. I said, I might as well do it, just see what it's like. And I've been on the board of a charter school for 10 years in Chicago. So, you know, I know a little bit about what it's like to help run a school at the local level. But I was curious to do it in a traditional public school, and I cared about the one in my neighborhood. And then when the filing period, just before it ended, another candidate entered. So suddenly it was a competitive race. Three guys running for two seats, including one incumbent. And, you know, I handed out a few flyers. It's very hard to meet the parents, who are the only ones who actually vote in these elections. They did a forum at the school, and no one showed up except the other candidates. Wow. So it was kind of silly.
Did you even have the forum?
Yeah. We had the forum. We all talked to each other. It was silly. And then, you know, a couple of times I handed out some flyers around the school, and, you know, I got shooed away by school people. So it just wasn't easy to do. I did provide some flyers to the school to send home with parents, which is what they asked us to do. But then the night before the election, somebody put out a very, very negative piece about me. I don't know who it was. I asked my opponents about it, and they both said they didn't do it. So I don't know who it was. You know, you can speculate, but I won't speculate. And it was just ugly. The principal was really upset about it. He sent out an email, said he was very disappointed that it happened. And he demanded that whoever was behind it stop. But I was actually out of town when it happened. So I wasn't even able to, there's no way to respond anyway, right? It was a flyer that went out to some parents. According to one guy, some kids were handing it out. So I don't get it, but it was disheartening, you know, the whole thing, you know, and, you know, losing is never fun, but it wasn't that big a deal to me. I was just really raising my hand to volunteer for the school. But, you know, I would think they ought to work harder to give parents a chance to meet meet candidates, especially when you have a competitive election. Just give them a chance to connect. That, you know, they could have told the parents, hey, in the coming weeks, you'll see candidates out front of the school handing out flyers, you know, get to know them, you know, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, that's my experience, and it gave me a little hint of what I think the elected school board races could turn into. They could be, get pretty contentious. I do know one candidate who's running for elected school board who told me that he met with the CTU, and after they asked him one or two questions about, you know, some issues that they cared about, they just said to him, look, we're going to crush you. So
we're going to, you know,
we're going to crush you. We're going to crush you. So, you know, that's what's coming. And, you know, people who are running going to have to be prepared for that. As I said, the signature requirements are high. The fact that it doesn't pay anything makes it difficult for a lot of people to take on that kind of a volunteer job. And, you know, the likelihood that they'll face a very, very aggressive political environment is also there. So the
negative flyer, without getting into the real particulars, I just need to know this. I just want to know this. We're curious. Did it hit you from an ideological standpoint, like presuming that you would take the school in a different direction ideologically, or did it make up all sorts of nasty, you know,
personal stuff? No, yeah. It was more about things I've written, but exaggerating it or misrepresenting things I've written, or just things in my background. As you know, I've worked for Arnie, I worked for Mayor Daley, I worked for Obama, and, you know, we were supportive of charter schools, we were supportive of accountability, we were supportive of high standards, and I still believe in those policies. So it took some of the things I had said or written out of context, and it just exaggerated my positions. And, you know, with the, under a headline, you know, Peter Cunningham will be bad for the school, you know. So it was just a little disappointing, but nothing I haven't seen before. I've been around politics a long time. I just didn't expect it there. And like I said, I wasn't even in town at the time in any kind of a position to do anything about it.
And so just so I know, the only people who could vote, did I hear that correctly, were the parents?
No, the whole community could vote, but they just don't. You know, this the election is just on a report card pickup day, April 10th. It's not primary day. It's not a day when anyone's going to vote. And, I mean, the total number of votes was in the low hundreds. So
got it. I see what you were saying. The only people on a practical purpose who do vote are parents.
Correct. And, yeah.
So how close was the election?
I don't know. That's another thing, is they never even share the numbers.
You might have won. They could be cheating.
They could be. I don't think so. The principal's a good guy. I don't think he would do that. But you know, I'm moving on, man.
Yeah, moving on. I hear
he was illustrative. You know, I mean,
I could just imagine what the flyer said. All right, let's move on.
You know, if they knew that I was a regular guest on the Ben Jarofsky show, I mean, I think maybe I could have won. I probably should have played that up a little
bit
more.
You should have played it, man.
Yeah. Oh, well, so it goes.
I've had so many conversations. I think I know the school you're alluding to. I remember having a conversation with you about the future of that school one time years ago in your living room. I don't know if you remember that conversation.
It's a wonderful school. It's a great school.
Yeah. If it's the same school I'm thinking of, it's a great school with a good principal.
Yep.
And some really great teachers, one of whom I know pretty well. Mm-hmm. And it's a shame. That they would do that to you. Because I've known this guy for a long time, ladies and gentlemen. I always joke is that he was the guy that Daley would send out to meet people like me. But he's got that ability, in my humble opinion, which is a very valuable ability, to talk to people from different camps. You know, when the teachers union needed someone to talk to Mayor Rahm, remember, he's going to get mad at me, I don't care, I'll say it again. With the hunger strikers at Diet School, Mayor Rahm wouldn't talk to the head of the teachers union, which is just so mind blowing. And so in desperation, they call Peter Cunningham. She called Peter Cunningham. Like, that says so much about where the Democratic Party is right now.
Much about how desperate they were.
it was a hunger strike. People were sick. My dear friend, Mark Kaplan. I mean, good people. And it's just, come on, guys. Anyway. All right. Peter, let's move on to the Dexter Reed case. This, wow, you could write a book on this.
Absolutely.
So many twists and turns.
Yeah. I have one like simple way of sort of trying to process it, and that is to think about everything that happened before the bullets started flying and then everything that happened after the bullets started flying, because there were a lot of mistakes before the bullets started flying. People, a guy I know who's very tuned into, you know, police policy pointed out that, first of all, you had 5 TAC guys in one car. So that's like really weird and unusual. 5 TAC officers in one car. Secondly, they're dressed in hoodies. It's very unprofessional looking. Third, they pulled up in front of the car, which you never do. You're supposed to pull up behind the car. Fourth, they get out of the car, you know, with their hands on their guns and ready to, you know, some of them. Or they were very quick to and trip, you know, they were dropping F-bombs everywhere. So there was a lot that happened. And, you know, how much training and de-escalation had these guys had, you know, under the consent decree, all that's supposed to be happening as well. And then they have this story that they pulled the guy over for a seatbelt violation, even though his windows were tinted. So there's just so much about just what caused this thing to happen in the first place that's bad. And now we have also learned that the individual had a lot of mental health issues. And so, you know, you just wish that somehow that could have been addressed. And then finally you have the moment of truth where he fires. And then after that, you know, you have so many bullets flying, which was crazy. You know, the videos I saw, it just looks like such total chaos. And so that's a whole separate analysis. And again, if it's true, and I believe it is, no one's denied it, that the individual Dexter fired first. You know, I certainly don't fault police for firing back someone who's firing them, but they escalated it. It escalated. I think it wasn't necessary. I don't want to judge people, but there were a lot of mistakes on the front end, even before the bullets started flying, as best I can tell.
Yeah. All right. So that's a very good synopsis of what went down. And again, this happened in March. I think it was, I'm doing this on the top of my head. March.
Right. You know, that's another thing is that, you know, a lot of people are angry at Andrea Kirsten for putting this video out. And they're saying you should have interviewed the police first. Well, I mean, it was weeks ago. Why haven't you interviewed the police?
Okay.
And that's also part of the problem.
Yeah.
So, you know, weeks go by and they don't get to interview the police. Why? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, so that's what I'm going to be calling the Mick Dumke question. And I told you before, last night I was at the Bulls game with Mick. We were just talking about this a lot. Dear friend of mine, investigative reporter for Block Club now. And so let me just go back and sum things up. And then so everybody knows exactly what's going on here. So the police shooting occurred. The exchange of fire that Peter just described occurred in March 21st, I want to say. Dexter Reed was killed. Thankfully nobody else was killed. And so it wasn't until April 11th. Follow me on that. I mean, how many, is that 3 weeks that the video?
Almost 3 weeks. Yeah.
And as the woman in charge, Andrea Kirsten, is an administrator for something called COPA, which Peter may be the only person in the city of Chicago who could tell you what that acronym stands for. But it's, I'm going to do this off the top of my head, civilian
oversight.
Oversight. I was going to say overview.
Police agency? I don't know what it is.
Police accountability, I want to say. The point is, it's the governmental entity that's supposed to oversee policing matters of disputes like this, investigate allegations of police
misconduct. Civilian Office of Police Accountability.
Yes, they hold police accountable. And there's been various entities who've had that responsibility down through the years since Peter and I moved to Chicago. They keep changing the name, but the mission basically.
IPRA was the previous one, and before that, they had the police board, and it is just an exercise in broken government that the process for investigating these things is still so up in the air. I don't know if you saw this story in the Sun-Times about how, like, here we are in 2024 and the state police, which has been under consideration for doing these things independently, is sort of slowly considering doing a pilot program. It's like there's no urgency. We've had so many of these cases in Chicago in the last 30 or 40 years, and it's just like no one has any desire to solve this quickly.
One has any desire to solve this quickly. And that is so true. We've been having, you and I personally been having a conversation about this stuff for over 20 years. Okay. And the issue existed long before we started having conversations about it.
Right.
I remember one of the Ralph Metcalf successfully running against Daley's machine, old man Daley, not the baby Daley that Peter wrote speeches for, old man Daley on this issue of police brutality and accountability and defeating Daley's handpicked candidate because the black community was sending a message. That was in 1976, I want to say, Peter. 1976, Peter.
Yeah, I know.
And so here we are in 2024, and I don't believe, it's almost a month after the shooting, that the police officers have been interviewed.
Right. And you have the police union openly advocating for keeping these disciplinary hearings secret.
Yes. Keep them secret. We haven't even had the interviews. And it's just, imagine, well, I don't even want to go down that path. But the point is, there was a shooting. Dexter was killed. I would think that the interviews would have happened within a day.
Yeah, or two, or three, whatever. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's conversations about doing them before they get a chance to look at the video. There's conversations about, I've heard conversations over the years and maybe some procedures to keep the guys separate so they can't, come up with coordinated stories. And sadly, this all is framed as anti-police. I think it's not anti-police. I think the truth is not anti-police. Getting to the truth and being fair and honest and open is just as pro-police as it is pro-reform or pro-victim, whatever. I mean, everybody wins when you're transparent and you're open. And, there's no question they made some mistakes. Like I said, there were a lot of things wrong on the front end. But now we're into a game of everybody's hiding the ball. Nobody really is open and honest about what's happened there. And what did we say in the car? What happened in the car before? Why'd you pull the guy over? A seatbelt violation? I mean, five PAC officers pulling someone over for a seatbelt violation? You got to be kidding me.
Well, and the way this game plays out in Chicago is information emerges about the people in the incident before we even have sort of the facts established. So in other words, as you pointed out, the Sun-Times had a story about Dexter and how he had some mental health issues.
Yep.
Kind of a detailed story about this man's life.
Yeah.
He did have a lot of mental health issues and a lot of issues, according to the article.
He was shot by his uncle.
Yeah.
Because he was threatening him with a knife.
That's correct. Yeah. So we know about him now. And we've also had an article or two in the Sun-Times, I think the Tribune may as well, about some of the police officers in that TAC group without naming them. And so we're getting slips and slabs of information, dribs and drabs, I should say, of information. And we still don't know, what was the official police response, as to why they did what they did, what went down. And listen, Peter, I think you probably agree with me. I have no problem with police officers absolutely having a lawyer with them when that interviews are asked. I mean, we have all criminal defense lawyers come on the show all the time. April Prayer, I see you out there, who say never answer questions in an investigation if you don't have your lawyer with you. Never, ever, ever. And that would be my advice to a police officer as well. Never, ever, ever go into a police interview with internal affairs, whatever they call it, unless you have some either your union rep with you or your a lawyer. That's personally my belief. I'll get your thoughts on that in a little while. But we haven't even had the interview, Peter. It's been a month.
Why would a police officer answer any questions at all? Why not just shut up completely?
Well,
I mean, okay. it, 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 Wouldn't the best legal advice be, don't tell anybody anything. Don't say anything to anybody. That's it. And so then the question is, well, do they have an obligation? They're public officials. You know, they use lethal force. Do they have an obligation to be clear about that? This isn't just citizens. You know, these are, you know, police officers, public servants who use their authority in a certain way. The authority to pull over a car, the authority to use lethal force. I mean, I think at the end of the day, if the facts show, and that by all indications they do, that he fired first, you know, I don't think these guys are going to get into trouble on that front. Okay? I mean, I don't think so. I mean, they may get in trouble for firing too many bullets back and overdoing it and emptying their gun into him after he's on the ground. These are horrific, horrific things. But the guy, you know, if in fact it shows that the guy fired first, I suspect they're going to be, you know, people are going to be sympathetic to that.
My guess is, if the facts show that Dexter refired first, then the overwhelming majority of people in Chicago
would support the cops. Yes,
there's just absolutely No doubt in my mind about that. And I know there's some activists who would not. I understand that, but yeah. I'm talking about my knowledge of Chicagoans, Peter, and overwhelming absolutely majority would support the police. There's no doubt in my mind about that.
Right.
But until you have like an investigation that's like an objective investigation,
right,
that establishes a certain facts, mm-hmm, a timeline, we don't know. We're basing it on this article in the paper, that article in the paper, this accusation here, that accusation here. And right, now, like you said, they're turning the attention. Like the police union and their allies in the political world, their aldermanic allies, their editorial allies, your dear friend Paul Vallis, they're turning their attention. They're making a scapegoat out of the public official whose job it is to review matters like this and get information out to the people like this. And she's right in a no-win situation here, in my humble opinion.
Right. I mean, I don't know. I don't know her. I haven't talked to her or talked to anybody in her world. But for all I know, maybe she was just getting stonewalled and she said, okay, I'm just releasing the video. I mean, we got to move this thing forward. So I just don't know enough about it. All I know is what's been public in the press. I don't know anything beyond that. But what's been public in the press is, you know, troubling on all fronts. Troubling because of the process, troubling because of what happened before the bullets started flying, and troubling in the post, you know, post-event procedures, you know.
Now, you raise an interesting point in passing, which I'm going to concentrate on for a bit. What if police officers just refused to testify?
Yeah.
They have a Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate themselves, and they have their lawyer with them. Well, they could already have done that, by the way. Okay. Yeah. They could have done that within 2 or 3 days.
Yeah. All we know, that's what happened. I don't know.
Wow. Well, I would have liked to believe that by now, that if that is what happened, which I don't believe that's what happened, that we would know that too by now. Do you follow what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, know she that might have told it. Kirsten might have said, you know, we've tried to interview them and they turned us down. I didn't hear her say that, so I don't know if that's true.
Yeah, no. But as far as I could tell from what I've read in the newspapers, and again, we're at a disadvantage here, both Peter and myself, because we're just going by what we're reading in the newspaper, because there's a lack.
And so this is you and me who read every word. What do you think the average?
Yeah,
the average people are who are busy and, you know, might catch some of the story, might see a little bit on TV. They see the video, they think it's horrible. They don't know everything about what happened. They don't know the history of the procedures. They don't, you know, I no one knows. And I only know because I've read a lot on it and, you know, been part of conversations about it a lot. And I still don't know most of what is right or wrong about this incident. A few things I do know are wrong, though.
So, all right. So while this was happening, there was one horrific crime after another that was also in the newspapers, including just horrible shootings in Brighton Park. I think I
back of the yards, back of the yards.
Right. I sent that article to you, as I recall, and it just leaves me numb. And so how, in your opinion, does the one case involving the shooting of Dexter Reed connect to the other cases of just ongoing crime in Chicago?
Well, both of them, in a way, raise the question of whether we can set up a system of preventing shootings before they happen. Now, in the case of Dexter Reed, it was known that he had severe mental health issues. It was known that he'd been shot before. Did that knowledge translate into the needed actions that could have prevented what happened? And by needed actions, I mean like trauma treatment, like red flag laws, like just support for the individual. You know, as you know, I work for Chicago CRED. We invest a lot of money and time and energy and love to support guys at risk of being shot or at risk of shooting. So we're in the business of trying to anticipate shootings and stopping them before they happen. That's what we try to do. Once the shooting happens, we try and support the families. We try and support the victims so that they don't retaliate. That's another attempt to prevent a retaliatory shooting. But the guy who's the shooter, you know, that's a police matter now. And you know, we're not against arresting shooters and putting them in jail. You know, people who shoot people should be arrested and put in jail. We're for that. But we're broadly speaking in the business of trying to prevent shootings. And, you know, you look at almost every time you see a shooting, you think, well, gee, how come we didn't know about this? How come we didn't know about that? How come we didn't know? So in the case of the back of the yards one, I don't know if we could have prevented that one. What I do know is that violence prevention work has begun in that community. It's a little behind some of the other communities, but there are groups working in the back of the yards. And I believe the analysis is that it was that, you know, they were aware of some of the street activity that led to that shooting. But you can't always stop it either. I mean, you know, what we do is we hire guys who are from that world, who understand it, and who have the trust and the respect to be able to walk up to those guys, you know, at considerable personal risk and ask them to put down their guns. And that's what our guys do. And frankly, we've lost guys in the course of their work. But, you know, the police can't do that. So that's something we can do that police cannot do. Mm-hmm. The police are increasingly welcoming of this help. Snelling is very open to it. Superintendent Snelling, I should say, I'm sorry, are increasingly open to it because they realize if we can prevent shootings, we're making them safer. We're making it safer for everybody. And we're doing things that they really can't do. They don't have we call it LTO, the license to operate. They don't have the LTO to walk up to these guys in their communities, on their turf, and say, hey, how can we get you guys out of this business? How can we get you into the legal economy? How can we help you get a job? How can we help you put down your gun? How can we help you live safely? And, you know, what we find over and over again is that that's what these guys want. They want someone to help them live safely. They want someone to help them put down their gun, but they don't have anybody who will do that. Everybody's going the other way. Get a gun because you feel unsafe. I don't know why Dexter Reed had a gun. We can't ask him anymore. Yeah. But he had one. And he was scared.
Yeah. Dexter Reed had a gun. And according to the Sun-Times, he had an exchange with his uncle, I think it was,
you
pointed out earlier. So something you said.
It doesn't sound like he was involved in it's like gang activity as people define it, you know? He was a basketball player. So it was a real mental health situation more than anything, I think.
Yeah. You mentioned that there seems to be more acceptance on the part of people in authority and toward the sort of.
Absolutely. Culture. You know, in February, we had an event on South Shore Cultural Center. We had 600 violence prevention workers down there, and we had the governor, we had the mayor. We had the two legislative leaders, Chris Welsh and Don Harmon. We had a bunch of aldermen. We had the business community. We had the foundation community all in a room together to announce an effort to start to take violence prevention to scale in a couple of neighborhoods, as many as we can afford. So, yeah, I mean, everybody wants to see this stuff succeed. Everyone wants to see it grow. It costs money. You know, it doesn't come free. But if it prevents shootings, it'll save money at the end of the day, because every time somebody gets shot in Chicago, the cost of policing and prosecution, incarceration, healthcare is around seven figures. You know, we've estimated the shootings can cost as much as $1 million every time we have one. We had 3,500 or 3,600 last year. That's $3.6 billion if that $1 million figure holds up. And we believe that there's a lot of a lot of truth behind that number.
How many shootings did you say we had last year?
I think we had about 3,600 last year. We had 4,400 in 21, which was the peak year for the last couple of years. I could look it up quickly, but I think we had about 3,600 shootings total. So that's like 10 a day, right? 365 days a year times 10 is 3,600 and 50. So, you know, that's 10 times a day on average someone in Chicago gets shot. And I think you said, you see the headline a few weeks back about the first day in 5 years or something where we had no shootings?
Yeah, I think you were
not a single one or something like that. I forget what the actual stat was, but it was something like that. It was important enough to get a headline.
So shootings are down. Yes. From one year to the next, are still way too high.
21 was the highest year in 20 years, 20 plus years since the 90s. And we were down in 22 and down in 23. And we're slightly down right now in 24 compared to 23. But we've had a rough couple of months, as you know. These mass shootings, you know, really drive the numbers.
Yeah. And then there's, I'll just read you this. I've already alluded to this article, the petition drive to give voters power to recall mayor. The opening line says, Mayor Johnson has his hands full with the migrant crisis. And then here's this part, a persistent robbery surge.
Yeah.
Wow. It's kind of hard to think of something like, it seems inherently contradictory to talk about a surge and something that's persistent, but whatever, putting that aside, how accurate do you think that is? I believe
that armed robberies have been up in the last couple of years, even as the homicide and shooting rates have gone down. But, you know, homicides and shootings are a lot worse than armed robberies. But nevertheless, and, you know, carjacking was up a lot. Car theft was up a lot. So there has been a lot of that. That doesn't diminish the fact that shootings and homicides are down. But it just shows that crime is a, you know, moving target sometimes, and you gotta be adaptable. You know, the police have to be nimble, and it moves between neighborhoods. It flares up in some neighborhoods and dies down in others, and you just got to be watching it every day. We have more ability to detect, track, analyze crime data than we have ever had in the history of the world. So, you know, there's no barrier to being smarter about, you know, how to deploy their resources.
Yeah, there's certainly to the point of the phrase that I just quoted, a notion in people's minds that robberies are up. Whether you could do one of your famous PC breakdowns of statistics to show that it's not as dramatic as people think it is, et cetera, and so forth. But it's in people's minds, Peter. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And let's face it, social media presents it to us every day. And so that's a factor in driving perception. But the numbers are the numbers. And the numbers of armed robberies have risen a lot in the last couple of years in Chicago. The number of car thefts have risen a lot. Carjacking has become more brazen. And to put a finer point on it, it's migrated into neighborhoods that traditionally felt safe, like Lincoln Park, Lakeview, things like that.
Yeah.
But on the whole, America's a whole lot safer than it was decades ago. And, you know, the other factor is there's so many guns. There's just so many guns. And I don't know, you see the city of Chicago is suing over the fact that Glock makes a gun that is very, very, very easy to convert into an automatic weapon.
Yeah.
So what you saw in New City, back of the yards recently, were automatic weapons. So you had, what, 9 victims in one shooting?
Yeah.
That all happened in seconds, including one fatality of a 9-year-old girl, I believe. Wow. So it's just a, you know, two or three other kids that are like in critical condition from bullet wounds. I mean, it's just insane.
Yeah. It's just the level of insanity. That's what I texted you. This is insane. I don't know what to say anymore. All right. We will now leave this very depressing conversation. I don't know if this will be any more uplifting, but pick your brain briefly about, maybe we'll do a whole show in a month or so about the state of the national election, Trump versus Biden. What's your general sense of where this thing is going?
Well, I think it's trending positively for Biden. I think ever since the State of the Union, where he really did a great job. And it's just inevitably tightening people who are thinking there's a possibility of another option, because a lot of people do feel he's too old, et cetera, and are now realizing there's not going to be another option. Meanwhile, Trump is sitting in a courtroom in New York. So I would say that things look more up for Joe. That said, you know, inflation is persistent. I'm feeling better about it. But this election is going to be won or lost in 6 or 7 states. And they're tough states, you know, Georgia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona. You know, the way the Electoral College works is it really comes down to those 6 or 7 states. And it has for the last 2 elections. When you add up the numbers of people that could swing one way or the other, you're talking about tens of thousands of voters nationwide who can flip the election. So it's going to be a nail biter. But, you know, I think it's trending towards Joe at the moment.
All right, that's a little optimism, because I definitely do not want fascism to come to America. That's me
speaking
to Cunningham. I view Trump's election as a very scary thing. And again,
me too. He's a horrific thing, a horrific person. And the fact that the Republican Party has given itself over to him is a disgrace.
Yeah.
I don't know how anyone can you know, proudly call themselves a Republican today.
All right. That was Peter Cunningham speaking. It sounded like me. All right. We'll close with this. I have nothing to do with politics. So, folks, if you listen to Peter on my show, you'll know he's a guitar player. He's got a band. He writes his own music, does a lot of cover songs. And as such, he's roughly my age, a little younger. But he came of age. I'm sure the Allman Brothers Band had an influence on young Peter Cunningham growing up in New York. And you can tell by that accent, he's not from Chicago, ladies and gentlemen. I got the news that Dickie Betts died right before we went on the air. And I quickly read his obituary. I do not play guitar. I'm very envious of people like Peter who can play guitar. But I am a master of air guitar. And I could do 3 Dickie Betts songs. I'm a virtuoso on Blue Skies, know every note in his riff in Jessica. I know every note, his riffs Ramblin' Man. I know every note. And then In Memory of Elizabeth Reed. Those are, I think, my favorite Dickie Betts songs. Your thoughts a little bit about the contributions of Dickie Betts to the guitar?
Oh my God, it's huge. You understated the influence of the Allman Brothers on me. They were far and away my favorite band in the early 1970s when I first started playing guitar. I fell in love with the dual guitars. I'd always loved the blues, and I just loved the interplay between Dwayne Allman and Dickie Betts. And Dwayne, of course, died way too young, at the age of 24. He was almost 25 in 1971, and Betts went on to carry that band along with Greg Allman for years and years. He's a huge influence. I can tell you the song Jessica, he wrote as a tribute to Django Reinhardt. Django had only 2 working fingers because he burned his fingers in the other in an accident when he was young. He was a gypsy guitar player. And Dickie Betts wrote Jessica, and that miraculous kind of theme, he played it just with 2 fingers as a tribute to Django. I love Dickie Betts. I loved his playing. In his later years, he split up, did a lot of other things. But he was a huge influence on me. And it's sad to see him go, but he had a great, great run. And, you know, as influential bands go, the Allman Brothers are right up there with anybody, whether it's the Beatles or Led Zeppelin. They pretty much created a genre, Southern rock, and they lasted for 50 plus years. And, you know, we're still listening to their music. And all those songs you mentioned, Blue Skies, Jessica, Ramblin' Man, In Memory of Elizabeth Reed, I could play every one of those solos note for note. So I love that band, and rest in peace, Dickie. Great guitar player.
And we're just talking about his guitar player, folks. And you're gonna read his obituary. You're gonna see it was a wild life, to put it mildly. And you talk about some mental issues. I mean, whatever.
He drank a lot in his older years, and.
I drank a lot in his younger years too, but the point I'm making, I do this all the time when we talk celebrities. I don't usually talk celebrities with you, Peter, but a lot of my guests, we do a lot of this conversation, like liking someone despite the life they lived. Do you follow what I'm saying? I mean, I really appreciate the art or the music or the comedy or fill in the blanks, various people who not good people, to put it mildly. And being my beloved John Lennon even talked about this, you know, in some of the songs he wrote. And I love John Lennon. So Bob Dylan is same. You know, you just got to put it aside to a certain degree if you really like the work they do. You know, Dickie Betts, Peter, I'd listen to like In Memory of Elizabeth Reed. And then when I got into jazz later, I'm like, oh my goodness, somehow or other, this 20-something-year-old white man from the South was listening to jazz.
Yep.
And he picked up. You get what I'm saying? You know, he crossed the cultural lines. And
oh my God, the Allman Brothers were so grounded in all the genres of American music: bluegrass, country, blues, jazz. Like they more than almost all these bands. There were so many bands from the 60s who listened to that stuff and liked it, you know, Dylan, etc. I mean, Hendrix, of course, was the greatest when it came to playing blues, in my opinion, from the rock world. Yeah. But they integrated all of that music in a way that no one, you know, gospel, that in a way that, you know, none of them did. You had a fantastic singer in Greg Allman. You had a fantastic two fantastic guitars. They had two drummers. They were from the South, and they had a black drummer in their band in 1969.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that was a big, big deal. They couldn't even eat in restaurants because of that. I mean, they're amazing, the Allman Brothers, and Dickie Betts was a big part of it.
All right, I'm going to call into this because I could say something, and it would be another hour of talking about the Allman Brothers and Dwayne Allman, too, who, yes, he died way, 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 way too young in a motorcycle accident. And so, anyway, I'm getting all choked up thinking about it. All right, Peter, thank you very much for taking the time to come on the show, and we'll look forward to a conversation. It's pretty much like every other month with you now, so I'll probably be talking to you. It's like a dentist appointment when you leave. I go, okay, you'll be hearing from me.
I know. I need my teeth cleaned, and I got to talk to Ben Jurafsky.
Very good. All right.
Maybe at the same time.
Yeah, maybe at the same time. Which one is more painful? I don't know. All right, that's great, Peter Cunningham. Thank you very much. Also want to thank producer Chris. He does an outstanding job, and I think Peter will agree with me when I say, hey, producer Chris, give yourself a raise. Take it out of petty cash. Peace and love, everybody.
And remember, previous Ben Jurafsky shows, all available for download at chicagoreader.com. You can follow Ben on Instagram at Benny J Show. I'm sure he's going to be sharing some Bulls clips, so you got to get in on that action. And don't forget to tell your friends about the show. Like, subscribe, and follow The Ben Jurafsky Show on all of your favorite streaming and podcasting platforms.